This recording is a production of the Conservative Anabaptist Education Committee. This presentation was recorded at Conservative Anabaptist School Board Institute 2018, held in Harrisonburg, Virginia on March 2 and 3.
Well, good afternoon to you all, or good morning rather. It is good to see you here. When there's a topic like this, I always wonder a bit whether people are here because they're interested in the topic or if it's because of a lack of alternatives or what it is. So don't know exactly why you're here this morning, but hopefully we can learn together. There's a handout going to be coming around, and I have cards that are coming around as well called Ask an Accountant. If you think of a question while I'm speaking, or several questions, jot them down. This afternoon we'll be having a Q&A session where I'll be addressing questions that you have. I'm going to be just kind of railroading through a bunch of information this morning, so not planning on taking time for question and answer this morning. But if you have questions, jot them down, get them to me. It'll give me a little bit of heads up where we're going this afternoon, and we'll go from there. So, about myself, I'm Dennis Yoder is my name, from Yoder Financial Services. We do a lot of tax and accounting work, are based in Guy's Mills, Pennsylvania. And one of my passions personally is serving nonprofits, including schools, churches, things like that. There's a lot of questions out there about how's all this stuff work with churches and donations and tax filings, and how can we be compliant? How can we? Another thing that we find is that school treasurers change constantly, and so what one treasurer learns may or may not get passed on to the next treasurer. So there's a lot of opportunity for growth there, is what we're finding. So I'm very passionate about that. My brother Eugene does a lot of work for me, and Eugene, I'd seen you earlier. Yes. Back there, if you wave to us. Two of us do a lot of individual taxes at this time of year especially, but also do quite a bit of nonprofit work as well. So this morning, as I said, I'm kind of going to be railroading through a bunch of things. Hopefully you don't get the feeling of this picture. You know, I have just a few suggestions about how you can do your job better. Let's start with volume one. Sometimes we get that feeling when we start looking at all the law and the tax code, and oh boy, we're just, you know, starting with volume one. Hopefully you don't get that feeling this morning. Hopefully here to that would be helpful, actually, if we could have the lights dimmed here, perhaps. So, in brief, why do we care about these things? And your handouts are going to have some of the slides that are up here, but not all of them. I tried to put things in your handouts that are going to be helpful for later. You also have room to take notes there if you wish. Why do I care about helping nonprofits have better governance, have better policies, and so forth? Well, I would reference the IRS, actually, in this. They, a few years ago, redesigned the form that they have nonprofits fill out every year, the tax form. And they put some questions on there about what policies do you have. Do you have a conflict of interest policy? Do you have a document retention policy? Do you have a whistleblower policy? And a lot of people in accounting said, well, what does this have to do with accounting? You don't need to have these policies to have accurate books and records. I mean, why does the IRS care about this? And the IRS said, actually, the reason we put these questions on the form is because we found a direct link between organizations that have these policies in place and organizations that are also being honest with their books and records. There's a direct link between the amount of organization that people have in their finances and the accuracy of those finances. So one of the reasons I really care about these things is because not only are we presenting numbers when we're giving a financial report, we're also representing how we're handling these funds, and the organization that we bring to it is a reflection on how well we're doing in accurately tracking these expenses. So this morning we're going to be, the talk's going to be mostly divided into two parts. One part will be on income, the other part will be on expenses, and income will be looking at things like what's a donation, what are some of the key elements of a valid donation receipt, how should scholarship income be reported. Beyond the expense side, we'll be looking at payroll. Is it really necessary? We'll be looking at what benefits must be included in payroll. We'll be looking at Can we offer discounts or scholarships to children of teachers? How should we report that? What are some things to look out for when we do that? And then if we have some time, we'll be looking at a few other tax items and some breaking news. So diving right in with income, what's a donation? The Evangelical Council for Financial Accountability gives a helpful definition. They say that charitable contributions are unconditional transfers of cash or other property to and for the use of a religious organization. They are tax deductible to the givers if given to and for the use of a religious organization to be used under its control to accomplish its exempt purposes. Now, there's a couple things that I'd like to point out on this definition. One of them is that they are unconditional transfers. So this is something where we are giving money or giving goods. We are not keeping any strings attached. So we can't say, we'll give them to you, but we might ask for them back later. We'll get into some specifics of what you can and can't restrict as a donor. But in general, it's an unconditional gift, no strings attached. There's also, getting ahead of myself here, there's also saying that it's for the use of a religious organization and they are under its control. Control is a huge deal when it comes to charitable contributions. What's a donation? What isn't a donation? Who has control over it? So here are two questions that you might get asked as a school board. One question, so a family is struggling to pay their tuition. As a friend, can I donate money to cover their tuition? Okay, so here's another question. Family struggling to pay their tuition, same scenario. As a school board, can we raise money to cover their tuition? So what's the difference between these two questions? Well, the primary difference is control. Who has control over the money? So in the first case, someone saying, can I pay someone else's tuition because they're struggling? Who has control over the money? It's the donor. The donor is maintaining control, saying, I want my money to be used in this particular way for this particular individual. Yes, they can do that. They cannot get a donation receipt. Here's why. They are not giving a gift to the school. They're giving a gift to an individual who happens to be a patron of the school. It's the same thing as if they were to go to the electric company and say, someone's struggling to pay their bill, can I pay their electric bill for them? Sure, you can do that. You can't get a donation receipt because you're giving a gift to an individual. You are not giving a gift to a school. Now, in the second question, as a school board, can we raise money to pay someone's tuition? Yes, you can. The difference there, and those would be charitable donations, you can give receipts for them. The difference is control. Who has control over the money? Who has control over how the request is being made and so forth? This can be a really sticky thing because you have good-hearted people that want to help, and so they give the money to the church, and the church helps someone. They give the money to the school, and the school helps someone. The big difference here is who's in control. So is this something where an individual is coming up with a need that they want to help, and so they give money through the school or through the church? That's a gift to an individual. Is the church or the school raising money for someone? That is now under the control of the church or of the school. That is now a valid donation. So it might feel like splitting hairs. The IRS says the big difference there is control. Who has control over the money and has control over how the money is being spent? I will also mention that you can have a scholarship fund. A lot of schools do that. They'll have a scholarship fund where people can donate to the school. The school then uses those funds to provide scholarships to people who are struggling to pay their tuition. Excellent way of providing donation receipts for donations for struggling families. I would highly recommend that. You do need to have a clear scholarship policy in place, and I'll talk about that some later, but it's very important to have a policy in place as far as who qualifies, how they can apply, and so on. So what about donations to a parochial school or a church school? If my school receives all its income from church offerings, can I deduct my tuition as a donation? So we don't actually charge, in this case, we don't actually charge tuition. The church completely supports the school. of course, families know about how much it takes, and so they're kind of expected to give up to a certain, you know, a certain amount for their children that are in school, but it's voluntary. Does that mean that now I can now get a donation receipt for everything that I'm paying? Well, here's what the IRS says about that, or about things like that. They say if taxpayers get something in return for their donation, they may have to reduce their deduction. Taxpayers can only deduct the amount that exceeds the fair market value of the benefit received. In other words, if I'm giving money and I'm getting something in return, the value of what I'm getting in return is not a donation. So take a fundraiser. I go to a chicken dinner and I give them a $50 check. Well, part of that is a donation. I wouldn't pay $50 for a chicken dinner. That's a good chicken dinner, but not sure it's worth quite that much. However, the portion that would be the fair market value of that dinner is not a donation. The rest is. My approach to the questions of donations to a parochial school would be the same way. So what's the benefit that you're receiving? And deduct that from what you're donating, and whatever is over and above that can be taken as a donation. So what about donations over and above the expected or suggested donation amount? Absolutely. That's definitely a donation. I don't have any children in school. If I choose to support the school, that's definitely a donation. If I had children in school, was giving a donation so that they can go to school, I wouldn't feel good about taking a donation deduction for that portion. But if I say, you know, I had a really good year in business, I'm going to give over and above that, absolutely. Over and above amount could definitely be taken as a donation. So since we're talking about donations, what are some of the critical elements of a donation receipt? The IRS says a few things that need to be included in every receipt in order to make them valid. One is the name of the organization. Generally, it's on a letterhead or something like that. The amount or description of the item received. So if it's cash or cash equivalents, you would put on the amount that you received. If it is the donation of a computer, the donation of goods, to the school, you would put on a description. You are not responsible to put on the value of non-cash items that your school receives. So non-cash items, the donor is actually responsible to have documentation in their files supporting how much they take off, because you don't know how much they paid for. They might say, well, this is worth $1,000, and they picked it up at a garage sale for, $20. You wouldn't want to get in a situation where you're giving them something that shows that it's worth that amount. Once non-cash donations reach the $5,000 threshold, then there are some requirements as far as getting a licensed appraiser to review it and so forth. But for most of us, that's not an issue. But the amount or description of the item received, a statement that no goods or services were provided by the organization in return for the donation. This one is really critical. Make sure that your receipts have this on. If they do not have this on, and the donor comes under audit, they will disallow the donation. You must put on there that no goods or services were provided in response for this gift. If you did provide goods or services in response, so in the case of a dinner, like I mentioned, you might put on there that $10 of value was given to them and the rest was a donation or something like that. You're supposed to list that on the receipt. But this statement is very critical. Also put the date on the receipt. Receipts must be contemporaneous, which means they must be given approximately at the time of donation. The IRS says that donation receipts must be given no later than either the due date of the person's tax return, which is generally April 15 of the following year, or the date that the person actually filed their return, whichever is earlier. In other words, if they file in March, then they must have a receipt by March in order to claim the donation. This is another big one that there was a recent court case where a large donation was thrown out because the receipt wasn't contemporaneous, and the church said that's ridiculous. So they said, well, actually, I think the issue was that it didn't have the statement on that no goods or services were provided. The church said, well, why are you throwing it out for that? So they issued them another receipt. Court threw it out again and said, it's not contemporaneous. You didn't give them the receipt in time, and so we can't allow them to take this deduction. Oddly enough, sometimes the court will say, we don't doubt that you gave the money, but we're not going to let you do it because you didn't have the proper documentation. how fair is that? But I guess they have to draw the line somewhere. A receipt is required for all cash donations and any other donations of $250 or more per donation. In other words, if this is cash, as in dollar bills, they must have a receipt. You cannot deduct cash donations unless you have a receipt, because you have no way of proving that you gave the donation. If, on the other hand, you give by check and your check is less than $250, even if throughout the year you give more than $250, as long as each individual check is under $250, your return check is sufficient documentation. But for any donations of $250 or more per donation, you must have a receipt in order to claim the deduction. So when is a donation recorded? General rule is the earlier of the postmark date or the date received. So in other words, the postmark date on the envelope, if you get it in the mail, the date it's actually received, if somebody hands it to you. There is an exception, and that is for a post-dated check. Don't see that often, but occasionally someone will give a check that's post-dated. Then the date on the check would actually be the donation date, just because you can't give a receipt before the gift was given. And if the check is dated in the future, it isn't actually given yet. It's not given until the date on the check. If someone wants to give a gift at the end of the year but doesn't want you to deposit it until the following year, they can tell you to hold the check. That's fine. Just make sure the check is dated, you know, currently, not in the future, because that could cause some issues. Reasonable estimate, if there's no postmark. More and more I'm seeing checks coming through for donations that are their bill pay, online bill pay. They don't have a check, they don't have a postmark date. I generally use the check date. That's usually the banks often date them ahead so that the date you receive them is about the check date. And so for those purposes, generally use a reasonable estimate. When do I think it was mailed? And go with that. It's not a big deal, except the end of the year. You probably all know what I'm referring to. So it's, you know, it's the donor that mails their donation on January 5 and expects a receipt from last year. I'm sorry, can't do that. It's not happening. So, scholarship disbursements. How many here are from schools in either Pennsylvania or Virginia? Can I see your hands? Okay, I assume that would be true. How many of you benefit from one of the tax credit scholarship programs in your school? Excellent. I figured there would be quite a few of you as well. I used to be the scholarship coordinator for Faith Builder Scholarship Services, and so this is a field that I've talked to a lot of people about. When I was thinking about this talk, I thought, you know, I'm going to throw this in here just because this is a point that I found a lot of schools have confusion on. There's this money coming in. How do we handle this? I would say sort of the bottom line on this is that scholarship disbursements are financial assistance for the recipients. They are not income for your school. If you have this scholarship program, the disbursement comes, that is not a donation to your school. It might feel like it because there's money coming in the mail for, you know, addressed to your school, but that money is intended to be used for the benefit of the individual who applied for the scholarship. So it's not a donation to the school. It's financial assistance for the recipient. Scholarships do enable schools to then raise their tuition. So how does your school benefit from this? The way your school benefits from it is that you can now raise your tuition to a level that is much closer to reality. We all know you don't charge tuition you actually need in order to survive, but you can raise your tuition to a level that's much closer to your actual expenses because those in lower income brackets are receiving financial help through the scholarship program. And you are also allowed to run a separate scholarship fund for patrons not receiving other scholarships. So, for example, you could have a policy that says that if you want a scholarship from our school, first you will apply to, you know, for a scholarship under these tax credit programs. And if you're denied there, then you can now apply for a scholarship from our school. That's fine. And your school can maintain a fund that would be used for that. It's a way that some schools provide assistance for those who, for one reason or another, may not qualify. Here in Virginia, there's, you know, it's common that you wouldn't qualify because your student might not be in the system. You know, if it's not a first grader or received a scholarship in the previous year, they can't be eligible and so forth. But one way that schools do this for those who may not qualify is to have a separate fund that provides scholarships for those other patrons. So, one question that we sometimes get is, can a nonprofit make a profit? Are they allowed to make a profit? What do you think? Definitely should make a profit. It'd be nice if they'd make a profit. Probably shouldn't make a profit. How many of you think you definitely should make a profit? Okay, we have a few brave souls. That's good. How about those who think that it'd be nice if they'd make a profit? Okay, yeah. Unfortunately, that's where we are in reality sometimes. How about those who think that we probably should not make a profit? All right, we got some of those. The reality is that the real question is who receives the profit. So the question is not, can you make a profit? I'm actually in the camp that you definitely should make a profit. Here's why. There are expenses that you should be saving up for. There are expenses that may not be on the books per se. It's things like improvements to your building. Well, those will be written off over a certain number of years, but you need all the money up front. You definitely should be making a profit. But the question is now who receives the profit. So there's the doctrine of private enormment. The IRS says there for a nonprofit, you cannot have private enormment. What that means is that no individual or business, no shareholder can benefit from the profits. So nonprofit simply means there's not profits being given out outside of the organization, all the profits staying in the organization. So can a nonprofit make a profit? Absolutely, and I think it's good if they do, but that profit, of course, stays inside the organization, hence the name nonprofit. All right, so moving on to expenses. And talking about payroll. This is a big one, and I will say that the services that we provide to nonprofits, probably this one's bigger than any other one, is providing payroll services. So whether it's, you know, full service payroll or whether it's supplying you with the information you need to write the checks and we do the quarterly filing and so forth, we're happy to do that. Payroll is complicated. For those of you who run it yourself, you know what I mean. There's quarterly filings, there's requirements to make sure the reports are done correctly, make sure they're done accurately. I had a school that I was working with a number of years ago that the quarterly reports and the annual report didn't match, and they didn't realize it. You know, it sent the reports in, the IRS wrote them a letter, it went to an old address that the IRS had on file, and till I came on the scene, it was nearly 10 years into this issue. They had enormous fines and penalties and interest on the fines, and it was kind of an interesting thing to untangle that, but believe it or not, the IRS reversed all of that. They had, in the meantime, had garnished the money that they had applied toward it, and they gave all that back, and they paid interest on the money that they gave back. So it wasn't too bad of a deal. Every once in a while, we get these opportunities as accountants. You feel like you're Superman or something. They come in with a $10,000 bill from the IRS, and they walk out with several thousand dollars of cash from the IRS. So that was a good day. But payroll is complicated, and keeping all that straight is crucial. So teachers, are they required to be employees? Can we make them subcontractors and just give them a neat little 1099 at the end of the year? I wish you could. That would be convenient. Not happening. So the IRS says there's 20 factors. The IRS has a 20-factor list that they go down through. And some of the things that they're looking at, they're looking at things like level of instruction. So how much control do you have over the worker? And this is applied to any industry. This isn't just teaching, but do you have control over when, where, and how the work is being done? Do you have control over the assistance of the person? In other words, not only are you hiring this person, you're also hiring someone to be their assistant. That indicates that they are probably an employee. If it was a contractor, they'd be hiring their own assistants. What about the continuity of relationship? Do they only work for you, or do they also work for other people? How about the method of payment? Do you pay them an hourly rate? Do you pay them on a weekly basis, on a monthly basis, on a semi-monthly basis? How about provision of tools and materials? Do you give them all the materials that they need to do their work? All of these things are pointing toward them being employees, not being subcontractors. How about the possibility to lose money? So as a subcontractor, you know, as a business owner, I know that in some cases, I lose money on some clients. It's just the way it is. Can your teachers lose money? You know, sometimes they lose money, sometimes they make money. And so, you know, what are these, when you look at these factors, they all point clearly toward employee. There's really no doubt in my mind that that teachers are required to be employees. How about tutors or special ed teachers? The person that comes in, you know, once a week and spends an hour doing special ed with someone. Here you get to a bit of a stickier question. And I would again refer you to these the 20 factors that the IRS uses. So are they only working for your school, or are they working for other schools as well? How much control do they have over their hours? How much control do you have over their hours? Is this a mom that's, you know, has done this kind of work in the past? She's very skilled at what she does. She could work for any school, really, but she happens to be in your church, and so she comes in. It doesn't suit her this week because of something in the family, so she's going to move the schedule. She has control over when she comes in. Things like that would point much more toward subcontractor. Now, I'm not going to say blanket across the board. They definitely are subcontractor. Be happy to discuss specific scenarios. I also have some brochures along from the IRS that describe this a little more in depth if you're interested. See me at the table, and I'll be happy to give you one of those. But I would say that it's much more likely that you could put a special ed teacher or a tutor on as a subcontractor. What about volunteers? Well, the definition of a volunteer is someone who receives no remuneration from you, from your organization. That means you're not cutting them a check. You are not cutting them a stipend. You are not giving them you're not giving them any money. What's more, you're not giving them any cash equivalents. Cash equivalents are gift certificates, gift cards, things like that. You're not giving them any of that. As long as those requirements are met, you have no filing requirements as far as they're concerned, because there's no financial things going on there. You can give them a gift, and we'll get to that later as far as what can you do, but you cannot give them cash or cash equivalents in order to still consider them a volunteer. What about board members? If they are serving in their role as a board member, they are considered an employee, which means if you pay them to come to a board meeting, they are then an employee. However, if they are working outside of the outside of their role as a board member, they might be a subcontractor. So a typical scenario would be a board member who also cuts the grass, and we pay him, you know, $50 a month to cut the grass. He can be a subcontractor as a landscaper, but still be an employee as a board member. The difference is, what is his role at that point? Now, if you have in your board policy that, you know, if you're the vice president, you cut the grass, okay, he's now serving as a board member when he's cutting the grass, and he would be considered an employee then. But as long as this is something that he's doing outside of his responsibilities as a board member, then you could consider him a subcontractor. So what about benefits? Are benefits taxed? And we're going to walk down through a few of these. What about reimbursements? So reimbursements do not need to be included in taxes. Those are simply paying a person back. That can also include mileage. So you can, the IRS says you can reimburse for this year up to 54 cents a mile, and that can be tax-free. You don't have to report that in any way. You are simply reimbursing the individual for work that they're doing, or for expenses that they're incurring on behalf of the organization. Would also say, if you're here as a board member and you're not receiving any reimbursement or anything like that from your school, you can deduct your mileage as a charitable donation to your school, because you are here on their behalf. And so if you do driving on behalf of the school, that can be deducted as a charitable donation. But reimbursements are not taxed. How about lodging? And this one comes up quite a bit. So, you know, we have a teacher from out of state. We give them a little bit of money that we're running through payroll, and then we provide them with a house, you know, a place to stay. Unfortunately, the value of that lodging is taxable. It's the same as if you were to pay them money and they were to pay their rent. Now, what's the value of that? Unfortunately, that's something you'll have to determine. You know, they're staying with a church family or they're whatever. If the church is paying them something for their lodging, then, you know, if they're receiving something on behalf of the teacher for their lodging, then it would be a taxable benefit to them. If, on the other hand, the family has an extra room and they're like, hey, they can stay there, we really don't care, we don't want anything for it, we're not getting a discount from her tuition or anything, they are now giving a gift to the teacher. My understanding is that that would not need to be included as payroll, but if the family is receiving something from the school or from the church for having the teacher there, that amount would be considered payroll, would be considered income for the teacher. How about bonuses? Well, bonuses, actually I'll take bonuses and gifts both at the same time. It really depends what those are. So are you giving them cash? Yes, it's payroll, it's taxable. Are you giving them cash equivalents, gift cards, gift certificates, that sort of thing? That would be taxable. On the other hand, are you giving them a quilt? Are you giving them a clock? Are you giving them a tangible item? That would not be taxable. Again, if it is cash or cash equivalents, it does need to be included in payroll. If it is an actual tangible item that you're giving them, it does not need to be included in payroll. I mentioned with volunteers that depending how you pay them or how you give them things, you might be able to do it and still consider them volunteers. This applies here. So if you give them a clock or you give them something as a token of appreciation for the work they did, that is not considered payment to them. If you give them cash or cash equivalents, it would be. How about discounts? You give discounts to maybe your school board members. You give discounts to your teachers for sending their children to school. Those are not taxable. And this is one special benefit that schools receive. In most businesses, discounts, especially large discounts, would be taxable benefits. But the law specifically says that in the case of an educational institution, teachers and staff can receive discounts or even free tuition for their children, and it is not considered a taxable benefit. What about scholarships? It would fall under the same thing. You do not need to report it as taxable income to the recipient, either for teachers or for your patrons as well. I will say, though, that, like I mentioned before, you do need to have a policy in place for the scholarships, which I will talk about in a bit. So what about payroll taxes? Are schools exempt from any payroll taxes? So there's a long list of payroll taxes, but I'll just address a few that are most critical here in this discussion. One of them is federal unemployment. Because schools are nonprofit organizations, they are automatically exempt from federal unemployment tax. So that one you can just cross right off your list. State unemployment varies from state to state. In Pennsylvania, nonprofit organizations are exempt from unemployment, but there's a portion that needs to be withheld from the employee's check. My understanding is they're not exempt from. In Virginia, if you have less than 4 employees as a nonprofit, you don't need to even file. You can be exempt even if you have more than that, but you do have to file a quarterly report. If you're a church or controlled by a church, you are automatically exempt from Virginia unemployment. So there's a lot of nuances there from state to state as far as how state unemployment applies to a nonprofit. How about Social Security and Medicare? So some of you are probably from churches where historically many of the people in your congregation would have been exempt from Social Security and Medicare tax. Your church can also be exempt from Social Security and Medicare tax if that's part of the teachings of your church, that you're opposed to insurance and things like that. If your members are eligible to be Social Security exempt, your church can also be Social Security exempt. What that means is that you do not need to withhold or pay the tax. If the teacher is also Social Security exempt, they would not need to pay the tax. If the teacher is not Social Security exempt, they would pay the full 15%, both the 7.5% that's normally paid by the school and the 7.5% that would normally be withheld. They are responsible to pay the whole amount. keep it in mind when you pay your teachers. If you're paying someone who's not exempt and your church has chosen to be exempt, that's a huge bill at the end of the year, especially for someone who might be on subsistence wages already. Nonprofit sometimes, unfortunately, doesn't only apply to the organization. Your teachers might feel a bit that way themselves. So keep that in mind if you are exempt as a church. There could be a huge bill. Some schools choose to do a year-end bonus. They calculate how much they think the tax bill is going to be as a result of this. Give a bonus at the end of the year. That would help to cover this tax. How about minimum wage requirements? Do those apply to schools? Yes and no. If your teachers are on an hourly wage, yes, it would apply. If your teachers are on a salary wage, the minimums, typically there's a minimum amount that you must pay someone in order to put them on salary, otherwise you have to be hourly. Those minimums do not apply to school teachers. There is a special exemption because of the specialized nature of school teaching, where they have to have a lot of education to do it and so forth. At least that's the general mentality. Then they can be exempt automatically from the requirement to pay them a certain minimum amount. So in general, as long as they're on salary, they can be exempt from minimum wage requirements. That could vary some from state to state, but on a federal level, that's the case. So I mentioned a scholarships policy. If you're looking to develop a scholarships policy, what are some of the things to think about as you look at that? One of the questions is, how do I apply? So if I want to apply for this scholarship, how do I go about that? What are the qualifications? Is there an income qualification? Is there like I mentioned, you could have a qualification where you only provide a scholarship from your school if they're denied from the state tax credit pool. How can I request more information? This is a critical one. Your people need to know about this program. So you can't just say, well, we're going to have this scholarship program. We're not going to tell anybody about it. We're only going to use it if we have to use it. In order to be a legitimate program, you really need to advertise this. I would recommend putting it in, whether it's in your handbook or on your tuition policy. If you have a tuition schedule, put it on the bottom there that scholarships may be available. For more information, contact this number. School office, contact the treasurer, whoever it might be. How can I request more information? How's my application reviewed? And maybe more importantly, who approves the application? And what process do they follow? It's crucial that you have this written down, and the reason is because you don't want to be in a situation where people start to accuse you of, in broad terms, insider trading or a conflict of interest where, the school board member received a scholarship, and we all know why, because he's the guy making the decisions. That might be completely false. It doesn't matter. If people believe it, it's reality to them. You don't want to put yourself in that situation. Write your policy down. It needs to be written so everybody can see it. They know that it's all being handled equally no matter who applies for the scholarship. And there is, an independent system in place to make sure that we don't have conflicts of interest in this process. Just a few other sort of random items to run through, other tax items. First, I would say that tax agencies don't send unimportant letters. So I mentioned the school that I got involved with that was, 10 years delinquent. It's not the only case where someone's been ignoring notices for way too long. I had a school I was working with recently who, because they didn't do annual tax filings, their nonprofit status was actually revoked, which there was a lot of confusion as to whether they needed to file or not, but the IRS thought they did, so they pulled their status. Again, until I got involved, it was several years down the road, and there's just a lot more negotiating and a lot more paperwork that's involved the longer you wait. Tax agencies don't send unimportant letters. If you get a letter from the IRS or from your local or state tax agency, open it, read it. If you don't know what it says, take it to your accountant and find out what you need to do and what's going on there. So is a school required to file an annual tax return? The big question here is, how is your school run? Is your school run as a church-controlled organization, or is your school an independent nonprofit? if your church if your school is a church-run or church-controlled organization, you do not need to file an annual tax return. It falls under the exemption that churches fall under. You really don't need to file anything other than, of course, payroll taxes. But as far as actual annual income taxes, you would not need to file any return as a school. On the other hand, if you're a nonprofit that is independent from church control, you would need to file a tax return. So what's that look like? What does church control look like? Are your board members selected by the church, or do they choose themselves? Are they what's called a self-perpetuating board, where they're electing their own replacements? That could indicate that they're not under the church. Does the church have veto capabilities in the case of policy changes, things like that? How about, are the ministers of the church involved in big decisions that the church makes? Can they override these decisions? I'm sorry, that the school makes. Can they override the decisions? In that case, it would be controlled by the church. If this is something that's operating independently, where perhaps it's several churches that send their children there, the board members are from those churches, but the churches really don't have any oversight on the school. In that case, it probably would be an independent nonprofit, and you would need to file an annual tax return. If you don't file an annual tax return for 3 consecutive years, the IRS can automatically revoke your nonprofit status. So it's something you don't want to throw away. If you've ever gone through the process of creating a nonprofit, you know it's quite a bit of paperwork. It's not impossible, but it's a lot of paperwork, and so you really don't want to throw it away once you receive your nonprofit status. Is a school required to have an audit? Here again, probably not. And the biggest reason is because most schools are controlled by the church. If you're controlled by the church, you would not need to have an audit because there's really no tax filing obligations. On the other hand, if you are an independent nonprofit, and the state of Pennsylvania, if you're over $500,000 in income, gross income per year, you have to have an audit. Other states vary as far as the requirements. For most schools, I would say you do not need to have an audit. You might want to get an audit. It might be a good idea to get one, even though you don't have to. That would be someone coming in. They would be looking through the files. They'd be looking at your policies. They'd be looking at, are you following your own policies? They would be just a variety of things that they look at. Can be a very good idea, a rigorous exercise to go through in the finances for your school, but generally would not be required. So just a bit of breaking news alerts, something that's coming down the pike. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, you may or may not have heard of that. What you may have heard of is the tax bill that Trump passed last year. That's what most people know this bill as. This is the technical name, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. There were a lot of changes in that bill. The biggest change to the tax code since, I think, 1986, which incidentally is the year I was born. But so they don't move very quickly when it comes to major tax reform. But in this bill, 2 things that could affect your school. One is they increase the standard deduction from $12,400 to $24,000 for a married couple. What does that mean for your school? The biggest thing is that donations only help someone on their taxes if they itemize donations. This means that if the combination of things like donations and property taxes and medical expenses and mortgage interest and state income taxes, if the combination of those is greater than their standard deduction, then the more they give, the more they benefit, because they're taking this off their income, paying tax on what's left. On the other hand, if they take the standard deduction, whether it's a donation or whether it's a gift or whatever it is, it really isn't going to benefit them on their taxes. I point this out just to say there's a lot of people that used to itemize deductions that will now be taking the standard deduction. What that means for your school is essentially that donation receipts aren't nearly as big a deal. The perception is still going to be out there that people are getting a benefit from these receipts. Give them the receipts. Doesn't matter. That's certainly not going to hurt. And it is best practice, definitely, to always give receipts. But I say this just simply to say it's not as big of a benefit, probably, for most people, their donations, versus, say, giving a gift to someone to help them with their tuition. Probably won't be as big a deal. Whether or not donations will actually decrease on a national level remains to be seen. Section 529 plans can now be used for K-12 education. So you probably, a good chance you haven't heard of Section 529 plans. Those in the past could only be used for college education. Section 529 plans are state-run, and so how they're actually administered varies from state to state. But in a lot of states, you can either take the donation off your income, or you can, in practically all states and on a federal level, you do not pay tax on interest that's earned within a 529 plan. So if you donate to a 529 plan, it earns a bunch of interest, and then you pull it back out and use it for, used to be, college, you would not pay tax on that increase. You can now use Section 529 plans to pay for K-12 education. This is a brand new thing. States are still trying to figure out what they're going to do with this, how this is going to work. One of the questions that has come up is, does the school need to be accredited in order to benefit from this? Is this any K-12 education? Stay tuned to that, but there could easily be patrons in your school that utilize these programs. There are some great tax benefits you can get on a state level. Potentially, you could donate to a Section 529 plan, write it off your state taxes, use that then to pay the following year's tuition, and essentially you have written your tuition off of your state income tax return. So some benefits here potentially for your patrons. Stay tuned. There'll be more information, I'm sure, there'll be coming out. Very briefly, I want to mention three different policies that I think every school should have in writing. I know we're practically out of time here, but I have these in your handout. Conflict of interest policy. What do you do when someone is voting on their daughter's salary who happens to be a teacher in the school? How do you handle things like that? You need to have a policy in place. Scholarship discount policy, I already mentioned that. Salary development policy, what's the process for developing these salaries? Where do you go to find information? Is it, do the board members talk to other schools, find out what they do, and then bring that back and you deliberate and you decide what you're gonna pay your people? Do you just, take an average of what the men in the church are earning and, that's what the teacher gets paid? How do you do this? So that is a policy that I think you ought to have in writing. As I mentioned this afternoon, we will be having a discussion time from 3 to 3:45. I invite you to attend that. If you have questions that you'd like an answer on, feel free to jot those down and either give them to me after the session, drop them off at my stand. I am in the library behind here, the same room as Faith Builders. I'll be there for most of the day. And you can also put your contact information down there. I'll try to also get you the answer in addition to using that for this discussion. So, thank you very much, Jonas. So, some of the most common services, we provide a variety of services. As I mentioned previously, we do a lot of individual and business income tax filings. So that's what we do. We do a lot of that. We also do, for nonprofits in this case, we do annual tax filings, so the 990s. If you're subject to charitable solicitation registration, we can help you get that figured out and registered for that. We also provide payroll services. So we do full service payroll where you send us, tell us what the salary amount is. Every, 2 weeks we send out direct deposits to the teacher. We can provide that level all the way down to the level of providing quarterly services for just the quarterly filings. So that is really up to what your needs are. Come see us back there. I'd be happy to discuss how we can help you out with your needs there. Thank you very much. You're dismissed.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.